Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 260, Touring South Africa pre-1880, World Events and Roland's Folly. An update about a railway building, 1879. We're touring the subcontinent today. Choose your mode of transport. Cape cart, ox wagon, bus, mule, on foot. Before the arrival of steam locomotion, roads in South Africa were little more than rutted tracks created by repeated passage of wagons and animal teams, rather than purpose-built carriageways. There was no formal road network in the early 19th century. Routes developed organically, where ox wagons, horse-drawn carts, and pack animals repeatedly traversed the landscape, linking farms, military posts, and markets, often taking months to traverse over rugged terrain. The primary transport machines on land before railways were ox wagons and horse-drawn vehicles. The ox wagon was the backbone of overland transport. It carried heavy goods from wool bales and foodstuffs to mining equipment over long distances and difficult terrain. Transport riders, both European and African, led these wagons into the interior, resting at outspans before continuing. Their significance was such that even towns and trails were defined by their routes. Before the age of railways, South African towns grew up along the overland routes forged by ox wagons, horses, and people on foot, and the rhythms of travel on those routes had a profound influence on where settlements were established and how they were spaced. In an era when roads were not engineered highways but repeated trails across the veld, the limits of what an ox wagon team or horse-mounted traveller could cover in a day shaped the practical distances between reliable stopping places, the watering spots, and the supply points, and ultimately played a role in the birth and growth of South African towns. Drawn by spans of oxen, often 8 to 18 animals harnessed in long teams, these wagons carried goods, families, and traders across great distances. Their average pace was slow by modern standards, typically around 20 kilometers a day, under good conditions depending on terrain, the weather, and the condition of the animals. This daily range was often the practical maximum that wagon drivers would plan for, and that distance became a natural unit for planning journeys, locating inns or outspan grazing grounds, and later for settlements that would service trafficked routes. Because of these constraints, towns tended to appear at intervals that corresponded roughly with a day's travel by ox wagon or horse, places where travellers could rest, water the animals and resupply or trade. These stopping points, sometimes initially little more than a watering hole or a crossing on a drift, acquired markets and services and sometimes a church or administrative function as traffic increased and the surrounding countryside was settled. Over time, these logical halting places evolved into permanent towns serving an increasingly local and itinerant population. The influence of wagon transport on urban form is also visible in the physical layout of these early towns. Streets and frontier settlements were often very wide, so that ox wagons with their broad turning circles could maneuver. For example, some early centres in the interior have boulevards over 30 metres wide, a legacy of accommodating these large vehicles long before railways arrived. In addition to sheer distance, access to water and grazing for animals was a key determinant in siting towns along these transport corridors. Oxen and horses needed adequate forage and water at the end of each day's trek, so settlements often grew up in places where these resources were reliable. As colonial expansion and trade into the interior intensified during the Great Trek and later around diamond and gold discoveries, these wagon road towns became hubs of commerce and service while maintaining spacing anchored in the limits of animal-powered travel. In addition to ox wagons, smaller two-wheeled carts and Cape carts, light horse-drawn carriages, were used for passenger and mail services. Cape carts, with canvas hoods and the seating for four, offered one of the fastest pre-railroad transport options across rough terrain. Road construction in this period was minimal. Often, efforts by colonial authorities simply to improve key passes or drift points, such as the historic Montague Pass, which opened in 1847 over the Otanequa Mountains, enabling faster movement between the coast and the interior. The first public railway service in South Africa marked a dramatic shift in land transport. The Natal Railway Company opened a small line in June 1860 and linked the point in Durban to Market Square using steam traction. This was one of the earliest operational stretches of railway in the country. Its first locomotive, the Natal, carried goods and passengers, representing a novel machine in the South African transport system and signaling a move away from animal-powered haulage. Almost simultaneously, railway construction began in the Cape Colony. In 1858 to 1862, the Cape Town Railway and Dock Company built the line from Cape Town to Wellington, opening sections to Oosterivier and then Stellenbosch by the early 1860s. These lines employed steam locomotives and rudimentary rolling stock, passenger coaches and goods wagons, the iron horse replacing oxen and horses over these corridors. By the 1870s, the pace of railway construction quickened. The Cape Colony government, especially after assuming control of private lines in 1873, embarked on ambitious expansion inland towards key economic centres, stimulated by the diamond discoveries at Kimberley in the late 1860s. Lines from Cape Town and Port Elizabeth were pushed northwards, and by 1876, 1877, several branches were opened, such as the Cape Main Line to Worcester and Port Elizabeth to Newton Hague. The steam engines used were the dominant transport machines on these early railways. They hauled mixed goods and passengers far more efficiently than wagons, dramatically reducing travel time and the cost over long distances. Smaller industrial and mining railways also appeared. For example, around 1871, two narrow-gauge steam locomotives, known as the Namaqualand 060T class, were placed in service on the mule-powered Namaqualand Railway between Port Nolloth and the copper mines, showing early adaption of steam to mining transport needs. In January 1877, the Natal Government Railways was formed, absorbing the Natal Railway Company and standardizing operations, adopting the Cape gauge 3'6" or 167mm, which later became South Africa's dominant rail gauge. Up to 1879, South African transport was thus characterized by a transition from animal-powered overland travel to mechanized rail transport. Ox wagons and horse-drawn carts remained essential for interior transport where railways had not yet reached, especially for freight beyond the railheads and for routes unsuitable for early rail grades. Steam locomotives and railway rolling stock became the primary means of long-distance haulage between ports and these emerging inland towns, offering far greater efficiency and capacity than wagons. The key difference lay in infrastructure and machine power. Roads were simple tracks molded by repeated wagon travel and natural landforms, while rail lines required engineered grades, bridges and tunnels, and dedicated rolling stock, locomotives and cars designed to move heavy loads over long distances. The economic logic of connecting ports like Cape Town, Port Elizabeth, East London, Durban to the interior markets and mineral fields drove this rapid adoption of railway technology. 1879 on the Julian calendar was well established, but it may come as a surprise to hear that the idea of a universal standard time was proposed early in February 1879 by a Scottish-Canadian engineer, Sanford Fleming. He dreamed up the idea of a prime meridian and the use of the 24-hour clock, which influenced the creation of coordinated universal time. That's after missing a train in Ireland because of a schedule which listed PM instead of AM. He then wrote a memoir called Terrestrial Time, changed it to Cosmopolitan Time. Eventually, he changed it to Cosmic Time. It was to take until 1929 for all major countries of the world to accept these time zones, just in time for commercial aviation, which of course cannot function without Universal Standard Time. Also in February 1879, Frank Woolworth opened his first 5-and-10-cent store in Utica, New York. His big idea was revolutionary. Every single item in the store would cost exactly 5 cents. Unfortunately, the location was poor, the inventory too limited. The store closed within weeks. Woolworth didn't give up. He analyzed what went wrong, realized he needed a better location and a bit more variety, and moved his operation to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Then on June 21st, 1879, he opened the Lancaster 5-cent store. This time it was a hit. It changed the face of both American and global retailing forever, offering fixed pricing. Who knew? Before Woolworth, most shopping involved haggling or asking a clerk for the price. Woolworth put price tags on everything, which was incredibly liberating for customers. He had open displays. He took goods out from behind the counter and put them on tables where people could actually touch and inspect them. By 1880, he realized he could sell much higher quality items if he bumped the price ceiling up just a bit, leading to the iconic five and dime, or the 5 and 10 cent model. This small shop in Lancaster eventually grew into a global empire with thousands of stores featuring the famous diamond logo and bright red storefronts. It essentially birthed the modern department store and the concept of discount shopping we see today across the world. What is relevant too for South Africans is also fascinating. In 1931, South African entrepreneur Max Sonnenberg opened his first store in Cape Town and chose the name Woolworths, specifically because the American F.W. Woolworth brand was already a global symbol of retail success. Believe it or not, at the time, the American company hadn't registered its trademark in South Africa, so Sonnenberg was legally able to use Woolworths. The two brands eventually became very different retail animals. The U.S. Woolworths remained a five-and-dime variety store focused on low-cost trinkets and household goods and lunch counters, while the SA Woolworths shifted towards a high-end premium model. In 1947, it formed a strategic partnership with the British retailer Marks & Spencer. This led the South African brand to focus on high-quality food and clothing, making it more of a luxury brand compared to the American discount original. Later in 1879, female students would be admitted to Oxford University for the first time, but it wasn't all happiness and light. Women attended lectures in subjects like classics and modern history and English literature, but these were pioneering students and not permitted to matriculate or take degrees or use the library. By 1892, women were permitted to study law, and Cornelia Sorabji was the first to study in the faculty. She was Indian. She was also the first woman to graduate from the University of Bombay. A true spirit of her age, Sorabji had an ambivalent attitude to British rule. She was wary of transplanting Western values to India, but she later opposed Mahatma Gandhi's campaign for Indian self-rule. To cap off an amazing life, she survived many attempts on her life by hardcore Indian traditionalists. So after that sojourn through the wonderful world of 1879, it's time to return to Zululand. That's where Lord Chelmsford was in a pickle. He had initially blamed the disaster to St. Luana on his 2IC, Pullain, and Durnford. But by February, a few weeks after the battle, the general inclination of the horse guards back home was to point the finger at Chelmsford instead. A memo signed by the guards' most senior officers said that he was ignorant of the position and number of Zulu forces. He shouldn't have left the camp. While an intelligence department memo on the same day blamed him for not fortifying the camp nor keeping up proper communication with Pullain and Durnford, and worse, for being fooled and led away by a decoy Zulu force. In the British Parliament, Conservative Prime Minister Disraeli was struggling to spin a way out after the terrible news from South Africa.
"It is a military disaster," he said in the House of Lords on the 13th of February. "A terrible military disaster, but I think we may say it is no more."
Before I'm attacked for the atrocious accents, just a note in my defence. I've researched Chelmsford's voice and Disraeli's voice. Chelmsford had a dry, precise manner of speaking in upper-class accent. Disraeli, deeper. Disraeli said Rorke's Drift had provided everyone with a silver lining and
exhibition of heroic valour by those who have been spared.
Yes, Disraeli's voice was apparently deep, resonant, melodious, a chest voice and a speaker, yet the master of the pause, and who would deliver a devastating insult with a deadpan face. Perhaps his most famous insult was the mic drop moment when asked to define the difference between a misfortune and a calamity. He aimed his sights at his great rival, William Gladstone, and said,
"If Mr. Gladstone fell into the Thames, that would be a misfortune. But if anyone pulled him out, that, I suppose, would be a calamity."
Disraeli's government was going to send thousands of British troops to Africa, which was a problem for the empire because it technically weakened British foreign policy. Russia had signed the Treaty of Berlin after the Crimean War,
and London had just defeated the Afghans. Any sign of weakness was ill-timed. Disraeli publicly shrugged off global fears, but privately it was another matter. He admitted in his papers that
"a terrible disaster has shaken me to the centre. I have not only to endure it, but to keep a bold front before an unscrupulous enemy."
And by enemy, he could either have been speaking about the Russians or the Liberals of Great Britain. Whether Liberal or Conservative, however, ordinary Britons were stunned. They only learned of a war in Zululand in early February 1879, more than a fortnight after the disaster at Sandlwana, more than a month after the war started. By early March, when Chelmsford's official report arrived, Queen Victoria was not impressed, and the final blow came for Chelmsford when he received a curt dispatch sent by the British Army Adjutant General Ellis. There were 7 points he should answer, demanded the Army Adjutant. 1. Why didn't Chelmsford organise defences at Rorke's Drift before he invaded Zululand? 2. Why was the Sandlwana not put into a state of defence? 3. Why wasn't Poulain given proper orders before Chelmsford marched off to save Dartmouth, who had been surrounded by a decoy Zulu force? 4. Why didn't his troops conduct reconnaissance of the country along the flanks of the Sandlwana? 5. When he heard the heavy firing coming from the Sandlwana, why didn't he send anyone to investigate? 6. Later, when he is informed that the camp was in the hands of the Zulu, what action did he take? And 7. Why were reserve rations and ammunition not secured? General Ellis himself was in the crosshairs. He represented the rigid, high Victorian military establishment that valued steadiness and drill above modern tactical flexibility. And it was Ellis who was a key supporter of Lord Chelmsford. Because he controlled the postings of senior officers, the Zulu War was in many ways an Ellis-approved campaign. He was the bureaucratic shield for Chelmsford, but he doubted the commander now. The public and the press and most parliamentarians clamoured for Chelmsford to be recalled. Like many other politicians before and since, Disraeli and his Conservative allies tried to double down on their defence, rejecting the calls, but as we all know, eventually the truth shall out. Cabinet members called for Sir Bartle Frere's head, along with Chelmsford. By dilly-dallying over this, Disraeli was to spell doom for his own political position. When it becomes apparent to a majority that a minority is lying in the face of overwhelming evidence, the political unravelling can be apocalyptic. For the politicians in England, things got a lot worse when the Queen herself began to come under attack, an almost unthinkable matter, back in 1879. By the end of March of that year, a vote in Parliament to recall both Frere and Chelmsford was lost, but only just. Disraeli's persuasive argument to his cabinet was that if they punished Chelmsford and Frere, then they would be punishing themselves, and he used an American example.
"For it is against Abraham Lincoln's dictum that it is unwise to swap horses while midstream."
As the fallout from Sandlwana bubbled away in Britain, in Zululand, Chelmsford was about to experience another military disaster, this time in the north. Colonel Rowland, who led the small column number 5, had been guarding the roads and garrisons in the Boer towns of the northeastern Transvaal. That was partly to protect them against the Zulu, but also to try and control the more volatile Boers who wanted to take advantage of the British losses in Zululand by rebelling against English rule. After the British defeat of Sandlwana and their retreat, Rowland's column was left exposed. Fitzwyoh's wide-awake spies realized column number 5 was a rather tasty morsel to be eaten up. Little did Rowland and his men know they were on the menu. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms that helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about various episodes. You can email me from there and sign up for a newsletter. Till next, au revoir.